Welcome back to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. On today's show, we have Katia Kolevaya. Katia is an award-winning lighting designer, communication strategist, and advocate of the lighting design profession. She is the founder of Arkivos. I hope I pronounced that right. She'll correct me in a minute if I didn't. And her international work combines architectural lighting with immersive lighting experiences and engaging marketing communications, collaborating with the best designers and brands to share their stories in an innovative and impactful way. She's involved in various community-based and educational projects in the lighting industry, like the Women in Lighting, the Silhouette Awards, and the VLD community, and the Lighting Police Project. We're going to find out more about all those soon. Katia loves sharing ideas and has been invited by various worldwide organizations and universities to talk about light, communication, light art, mentorship, and inspiration, amongst others. Her website is Katia Kolevaya, that's KatiaKolevaa.com, and then you can find her link tree and all of her social media on the GetAGripOnLighting.com website. But before we go there, Greg, we got to go to the gangsters down in New York. Satco, light thing, right thing, Greg, SATCO.com.
That's right. They're LED PIR sensor lamps. They have an A19 and a PAR 38 that actually have the sensor built onto the lamp itself. I've seen this application needed in many commercial applications, you know, especially like multi-housing. Someone has a porch light and they want to have it motion activated without changing the whole fixture. Now you can do it with a light bulb. A19, PAR 38, wet location listed. 5 minutes on when motion is detected and dusted on operation as well, built right into it, photocell.
Less garbage, buddy. That's what I would say. That's less garbage. Leave that socket there, screw the thing in, and move on with your life. Go to SATCO.com, that's right. And, of course, the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. Greg's got to turn off the alerts on his computer while I'm finishing off this intro. But what I'll say about that is, the National Association, we're having a convention in September. This convention is where the distributors, guys and gals like you out there that have warehouses and order desks and counter sales, we get together and we figure out how it should be done. That's right. We discuss all the issues related to doing that every day, selling light bulbs every day, selling light fixtures, doing projects, all that kind of stuff. Why don't you consider joining Nailed and coming down to the convention? Why? Because you don't know everything, sucka. That's right. You think you know it all? Why don't you come hang out with some of your peers down at Nailed? And you guess what? You're going to find out there's a lot to learn. And every time I go, I learn, Greg Garrick.
That's right. That's what I do, too. That's why we're here.
NEILD.org. Katia, welcome to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here. And I can't wait to have this discussion with you guys.
Well, it's certainly our pleasure. Greg?
Yeah. You know, the thing that really stuck out to me is something that we've talked about a lot on different shows and has come up is lighting industry needs police if they really want to enforce doing the right thing and getting lighting done the right way. And you started this, so the lighting police. What do you got going on here? What is this all about?
Okay. Well, you're starting straight into the topic, which I love. I wouldn't say, though, that the lighting police is the solution on what you said about the lighting industry. Let me tell you what it is about. So the lighting police really is an educational platform raising awareness about the importance of the right light to the general public. So with the support of the lighting industry, even if this is lighting designers, manufacturers, and various other people, associations, people that they are part of the industry, they support and they create educational content, but in the most simplified way. So our friends, our parents, our family members can understand what we mean by, you know, right light and designed light. And there are lots of different various things that we need to communicate with them. And so the lighting police, actually, it started really as a joke. And if you want me to get there, I will get there when you ask me for it. But it's very interesting how it started and why. But if we can just summarize again what it is about, is educational platform, mainly active on social media. You can find us on Instagram and LinkedIn. And on Instagram really is where the biggest engagement is happening, with lots of people around the world contributing and sharing stories from all around different countries. I think we have 45 right now. And so, yeah, it's like a constantly growing platform with support from various professionals around the world. And again, if I can share some numbers, right now we are on 21 global experts that are located in various countries in the world, including Canada, US, and, well, I have a list of the countries that we are there, but you can obviously find all of those things if you join the social media accounts, yeah?
Very good. Yeah, and that led me to my next question, which maybe I could have started with, but where did the idea come from? When and where and how, and give us a whole background.
Okay, fantastic, fantastic. So, okay, so maybe I should give a little bit of background for myself. Obviously, Michael already shared a few things about me. Thank you very much for the intro. But I'm a lighting designer myself, and I'm like a big, big advocate of the lighting profession. I'm not many years in the industry. You know, many people think that I'm here for lots of like many years, but I graduated my master's in lighting from KTH in 2017. And then took an approach on light and communication and more interactive and more, you know, like media facades and more this type of part of the industry, although always connected with the architectural lighting world, knowing all about new products and technologies and all of that. But my approach was always more into the communication and how light creates all these emotions and all of that. So I moved in London. I started working there as a lighting designer in a company. And we are in February 2020, weirdly enough, just a month before the SeaWorld, yeah. So
what happened there... then?
Do you want to tell? But yes, so basically, this is the day when the platform started, February 2020. The platform, when I'm saying the platform, I mean the social media accounts on Instagram and LinkedIn. But before we get there, the whole idea came on a day that I was in a museum in London. Maybe I shouldn't mention the name because apparently, as I discovered later, I had to be very careful with this approach of, well, how'd say, reacting and talking about not right lighting in the urban space. Okay. My lawyer that actually I never thought that I should have one, right? So, okay. So I'm not going to mention the museum that I was there, but obviously maybe some of the listeners could actually guess and understand what I'm talking about when I will continue. So I was there in a museum in London, and there was this big area with Greek sculptures inside. And I have been there multiple times to just, you know, see the sculptures and all of that. I love like history and, well, it's a very important part of being in London. And then I was there for maybe it was my third time. And I was a little bit bored, to be honest, because I was just visiting for some friends. And I started observing around the light. I'm always doing that. It's something that you cannot really control as a lighting designer. You know, you get into a space and you just see the lights. But I was just observing.
That. We know all about
you
that.
You do? Right? Yes, exactly. it's kind of like, you know, a gem that we have, like being lighting geeks. But I was there then and I started like taking some pictures because I could see some parts of the big room there not being lit, or some lights were very orange greenish, and obviously it was like metal halide, not maintained, very old equipment that, you know, nobody has kind of like cleaned maybe. And I mean, we are not going to get there, it's not the point, but I was just observing an area that I have been there multiple times, and some lights weren't working and some sculptures weren't lit. So I just took some pictures. I was a little bit more, how can I say, a little bit more aggressive. So I took the picture up and I put what the F word with some stars and question marks. And then I said, okay, is this designed or not? And I actually tagged the museum. Well, FYI, don't do that, right? It's not the right approach. Well, I was lucky that nothing happened, but it could happen. So yeah, we have some rules, which I'm going to share with you later on in this discussion. But I did that, and then I put another picture up there on my Instagram, Archifos community, and it was about some sculptures not being lit. And then I said, okay, I mean, at least everything should be lit and enhanced, and it's a very important space, and blah, blah, blah. And then the third story, it was, okay, I'm serious here. I'm going to start the lighting police. Who is with me? We need some global support. It happened just like that. I also put like an emoji of this alarm, you know, red, blue emoji on Instagram. And I just sent that. Like, it wasn't anything that I thought. It was just an instinct reaction of just me being lighting obsessed and just, you know, being like, okay, what is happening? What is going on? And I think if I remember correctly, it was almost 100 people that responded on this same day on this kind of call to action, yeah, saying that, oh, we need that in Mexico, we need that in Russia, we need that there, we need that there. And I was like, oh, wow, that's something that people, or at least my audience, is interested, because it looks like we are all looking for those things. And then the next day, I decided to just open this account and just keep it like, yeah, like this. This is how it started. I don't know if you were expecting something else, but it was really kind of
like, I love the idea. I love the idea. And, you know, I think we're soulmates, Katya, you and I, because I have a tendency to get myself into trouble with various institutions in the lighting industry on a regular basis.
Nice.
And,
nice.
And you know, listen, what's happening when you point something out like that is somebody's ego is being offended. Okay. There's what's wrong with saying the lights burned out? What's wrong with saying that metal halides lumen depreciation is at 80% and is turning green? What the F? Yeah, this piece of artwork or this statue from antiquity needs to be lit up properly, and it's a tragedy of the commons when it's not. So deal with it, sucka, at the whatever museum you're at. Sorry, but you know, this is a mistake, and this is a lighting professional pointing it out, so too bad for you. So I applaud you on that, and I think it's great that people are going around doing this, because look at electric light is very important in our lives, and so especially in a place like a museum that should be lit up impeccably.
Absolutely agree. But then this really brings us to the whole vision of the project, because I just want to make sure to point out that, yeah, I absolutely agree with you from the perspective that we are the experts and we have the responsibility to ask for, you know, the lighting professional to be included in all of those projects, to be asked to improve and maintain things and redo. So there is a lot of this part of how it should be. But then the whole purpose and mission of the project turn to be not really to point out and blame or shame. That's very important. And that's the reason why maybe in the beginning, Scott, I kind of like reacted like that, well, the lighting police is not going to save the lighting industry. But it's more about raising awareness and making sure that every single person in the world understands the value of the right light. Like, even if this is on the way of improving your mental health and well-being and productivity and overall life, or what it means, you know, when you go to a restaurant and you are just sitting down and then there is a light that is controlled from one place, like all the lights are controlled from one place. And actually, this is an actual story that happened to me. And then you're sitting in a table, very reflective, and then you see the light just flashing. And you know, you have to eat. Yeah. And
oh, God. Flickering lights are horrible.
Exactly. And what do you do there? Do you ask the responsible person to come and switch off the lights or change your table? Or do you just stick with that and you stay there? And what do you do? Like, and I'm not asking us, right? That we are.
It's a rhetorical question.
That we...
I understand.
Exactly.
But so I think there's a difference between an institution and a small restaurant. Okay, I think there's a difference between those two things. So if you're eating a bowl of faux gras at a soup store quickly and the light's flickering, you know what? Suck it up, okay? But if it's an institution, a major public institution or industry institution, yes, it needs to be pointed out. But, you know, I want to just, you know, I'm going to go on a slight tangent here, Greg Eric, if you don't mind, and then I'll put it back over to you for the next question. One of the great realizations of my life is that when you're blamed for something, instead of lashing out like a loser, right, instead of getting defensive, ask yourself, is it actually your fault? And if you do that self-examination, Greg, and you find out that it is your fault, get down on your knees and thank God, because that's a problem you can fix for the world. You can fix it. And so instead of calling your lawyer and threatening people and lashing out or whatever, accept responsibility, Greg Eric. Get something done.
Get a grip.
Get a grip.
Yes. So starting off, I want to get back into the lighting police a little bit, but you said in 2017 is when you started in lighting?
No, sorry. I started in lighting 2017. Yes, exactly. The project started in 2020.
Right. So in 2017, what got you interested in lighting? And then a follow-up question is, how do you know about metal halide if you started in 2017?
Yeah, actually, that's a fair point. I'm really, really grateful that I studied at KTH in Stockholm, and it was a fantastic experience. I'm an interior architect. This is what I studied in Greece and Spain. And in a conference, weirdly enough, that it was all about lighting in Greece, I find out that this is a profession. And then I fell in love with it. And then nothing. I never worked in architectural, interior architecture. Never. I loved it. I was really appreciating everything, but then when light came to my life, that's it. So I studied there at KTH, and we had a very, very good program there talking about all different types of lights, including metal halide. And if I remember correctly, we had a lot of hands-on workshops and things, you know, to illuminate the dark Stockholm during winter. And so we did work with metal halide equipment as well. So like we really had a very good experience of really understanding the fixtures. Although that's a very good question, Greg, because lots of my colleagues and people that I discovered later on in my professional career were working with all of those different types of lights before LED, which I have never worked really. I have never specified anything else than LED in projects. Well, some tungsten as well, but that was on my film industry kind of expertise. You asked me about my interest in lighting, and as I said in the very beginning, during my studies at KTH, I discovered very early on that where I was more interested, it wasn't the architectural lighting itself on really creating these beautiful spaces and ambiences using light, but it was more into how do you bring this additional element, this emotional element into the space using light. So we're talking a lot about interactive lighting, about sensors, about colors, about more this kind of engagement between the people that they are the users of the space. And this led me then to look for a job that was really focused on that, doing immersive experiences and installations, ephemeral installations for fashion shows, product launches, and this type of thing. So my expertise as a lighting designer is more towards this part of the industry, more ephemeral and more artistic approach, I would say.
So we started this podcast in 2017, and as we've interviewed, so we've done over 300 podcasts, and we've done so many shows. We've noticed that there seems to be like a collision between theatrical lighting and general lighting, and they seem to be coming together into one. And it like there's bursts of where it seems to happen more often. In your practice, are you combining theatrical elements into your lighting systems?
Yes, for sure. Yes, and it's also like if you think about it, it's also like the approach of the theatrical lighting. Again, there's this ephemeral part, but if you think about some characteristics of the theatrical lighting, you can see them in architectural lighting as well, but in a different way, like talking about gobos, talking about lenses in architectural lighting, right? How do you control the light in the way that you want? Or talking about rhythm, patterns, intensity, creating, you know, like all of those scenarios. So I think that there is a, like an interplay of all of those things. And it's interesting enough that lots of people in the lighting industry that they don't have like a master's degree. Like if we talk about people older, like older generations than me, most of the people were either like in stage lighting or architecture, and then they discovered this path of being like architectural lighting designer. So what you're talking about starting the podcast in 2017, I think it's like I can really connect the dots there of looking at more and more like an interdisciplinary approach of people coming together and utilizing more characteristics of theater and film. Like in the company that I was working on during my work in London, we were using like filming equipment from the film industry, combining it with architectural lighting products and doing something like in a complete different way. So I think it's a matter of imagination, budget, and you know, like really combining your creativity together with the tools that you have. So
I've often said on this show that interior design is really lighting design. Everything else is kind of secondary to the lighting design. And the best interior designers are lighting designers first, actually. Most importantly are lighting designers. As a designer, when you're entering the space, do you have any influence at all over the other aspects of things and furniture or anything like that that goes into the space? Or are you consulting with them in terms of the colors of walls? Or tell me a little bit more about the holistic process of the design and how you're involved in it.
Yeah, so it's definitely all about collaboration here. And for me, as being an interior architect at the first place and having studied that without really experience, to be honest with you, but with having studying that and understanding like that each expert should know about light and should know about things, but they should be working together with the right person that is going to be going in depth into all the details. So I get the point of what you're saying about all the interior architects should be also lighting designers. I don't see that, at least on my kind of field of, you know, collaborators, clients, and the people around me.
I said designers, not architects. I said the designers.
Designers, yes. The interior designers, you said,
yes,
right?
Yes, the interior designers. Not the architects,
yes. And I do see interest, but nobody from interior architecture is really have studied lighting necessarily.
Tragedy.
So I see like a big, exactly. I see like a big gap between the educational system. Like when I was studying interior architecture, we had the course in lighting, but only one. It was like one for a semester. And I was really lucky because the professor of this class, he was also a lighting designer from UCL. So he was an architect and lighting designer. So he helped me to open up and understand that this is like a complete section on its own. But I do believe on specialization. I do believe on that. Like, I believe that we cannot do everything, you know. Maybe we can, but maybe we should not. That's the thing. A project can really be successful by combining all the right experts together. This is how I see the industry, and this is how I work in all the different projects that I'm doing. I'm always trying to really bring the best people there. Like if we're talking about an immersive experience, we need a sound designer, right? Like we're going to get a person who is going to be expert on that. We need a person who is really great with programming and all of those different interactive things. I know how to program, but it's not my role to try to tick all the boxes. I'm the designer. I'm bringing the vision. I'm bringing the concept. I'm connecting the dots. But I need to have this team of experts that they are really good on what they do. So to go back to your question about the materials and the textures and all of that, of course, on an architectural lighting project, the interior designer and the architect are the ones who should be leading the general atmosphere of the space. And then the lighting designer, us, with our expertise on how lights work, the color temperature, the reflections, the materials, and all of that, we should be consulting them and maximizing their vision with our design. Beautiful. So it's a matter of, you know, combining everything, marrying everything together. Yeah. Mm.
The before I turn it back to Greg, I want to ask you an intimate question because it's come up on the show a couple times. How are you compensated? Do you get paid as a percentage of the fixtures sold into a project? Are you paid as a separate fee as a lighting designer?
Yes, so definitely the second one. I'm a really, as a very big advocate of the lighting profession, and also, you know, part of a supporting part of what ILD is standing and talking about, I do believe that lighting designers, we should be all independent. I do understand that there are lots of different markets in the world, right? Like for me, working in the UK, working in London, I could really see this whole independent lighting design module of consultancies that they are compensated for their design job and for their design schemes. And, you know, depending on the different phases that they are compensated accordingly. However, in Greece, that I'm also originally from Greece, and I'm right now like spending a lot of my time here and observing the market, we see a different kind of model, that there are very few independent lighting designers. There are lots of designers that they are compensated, as you said, with some sort of percentage on top of the design work. So for me, to answer the question, like when I do a design job like that, I'm always in the independent aspect of getting compensated for my design concept. But again, you are touching now a very interesting point, because as Archifos, my business is working a lot with manufacturers as well. I'm doing a lot of things in communication strategy and combining my lighting design expertise and my passion for communication and network and community with people. And I do work a lot with manufacturers, like doing partnerships and collaborations. I'm getting reviewing products and things like that. So it's kind of like Katya in two parts of collaborating with manufacturers as Archifos, and then Katya being the lighting designer independently when I'm doing design projects. Yeah.
I think, you know, from my perspective, I think there's pros and cons to the models that are out there. But I think the lighting design profession could do a better job promoting that IALD model, that the lighting designer is separate. And I think as the project increases in complexity, it inures to the benefit of having a separate lighting designer who's compensated for the design. And as the project simplifies, it inures to the benefit of having, like, if you're a factory and you want to change your outdoor lights, call Michael Colligan. He'll go set it up for you real quick. He'll take care of everything and it's going to be perfect. And all you got to do is pay for the installation and the materials. Same with Greg Eric. And so as it depends on the complexity. And I think the design community could do a better job at, you know, kind of marketing that to more complex projects, because you can have extremely complex projects that are working with manufacturers' reps who are doing the lighting design. And in that case, I would say that's probably the worst scenario, to have a manufacturer representatives designing a project for a very high-end complex project, because they're not necessarily going to pick the best stuff. They're going to be stuck with a certain manufacturer. And then on top of that, they're going to build the project spec in a way that they maximize the amount of money they receive for the sale of the fixtures.
And also more lights and, you know, like, again, connecting it with lighting police, more light pollution as well, and more, you know, lots of different things. But I just wanted to make a point there about the responsibility that we all have in the industry to market this And really, it goes back to educating our clients and educating the industry and the people, the general public. I still have lots of friends and people around me that they don't understand what the lighting designer does. And some people, maybe, you know, when I meet somebody and like, yeah, I'm a lighting designer. And I'm like, what is that? Are you doing the light bulbs or what are you doing? And I'm trying to explain that what I'm doing is really creating the atmosphere of the space, even if this is like a restaurant or a concert or a theater, theatrical performance, like trying to let them understand that the light that they see, it's designed, it should be designed. And actually ILD has a very, very good quote on that, that good lighting doesn't just happen, it's designed. And on the Lighting Police, we are really big advocates of that and talking about it when those different conversations appearing on social media of why this is like that and why it should be, how it should be, and why, you know, why it's not cohesive or why the facade looks like that. And it's like, because you need to call a lighting designer to bring the lighting designer in the project. So it's all about education and it's all about awareness. And that's really the pure mission and purpose behind the Lighting Police educational platform.
And I was looking on your site here, your link tree, you know, that's your mission, is to raise the awareness for the importance of the right light. And you have a few different ways you can take part in it. Can you kind of break that down and tell us what the avenues they are or people listening can do to participate?
For the Lighting Police, right?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Perfect. So the first part is that we have an advisory board on the Lighting Police. And this is an open call to everyone who is listening right now. And in general, like really to connect the dots and create like a strong network of people, experts in the lighting industry, but also not only in the lighting industry. We envision that in the future, we're going to be having experts from sociology and maybe even from the politicians aspect. And, you know, like in London, we have also a mayor of the nighttime economy. Mm. And in the US as well, like Lenny Squendinger is really involved in lots of different things about the nighttime economy and municipalities and all of that. So there are people around the world that they are actually experts on combining lighting design knowledge, but also social and all the other aspects. So one part of being involved is to approach us, approach the Lighting Police core team, and express your interest to become member of the advisory board. The advisory board, really, what they do, they are approving and supporting the core team of the Lighting Police to create the educational content that we put out there. So if we split it down into, I mean, again, now I'm going somewhere else. So maybe I should finish that part and then I'm going to talk about the content. So ways to connect and be part of this global movement. One is to be part of the advisory board. Two is to contribute, just be aware of the light around you and take a picture or a video, upload it on social media as stories, tag the Lighting Police and start a conversation. And we have lots of that. And actually, this is the way how this platform has grown to what it is today. We have very, I mean, I'm looking at my screen now and I'm looking at the Instagram page of the project. And imagine that we have only 74 posts as today, which is very little content if you think about it compared to the number of the following and the network and the community that we are building. And this whole thing is because of the constant, almost daily global stories that people are sharing from all around the world, tagging the project. And then we are resharing and we are giving some sort of input, or we are asking our community to pick between A or B, you know, like kind of, what do you think should be there? This one or this one? Why do you think that this doesn't work? Because of problem with the driver or because of this or because of that? Something very important to mention here is that everything needs to be super, super simplified. We don't want to be there and creating content that talks about very complex things of light and how this flicker thing works and this and that. Like, we want to make sure that my parents really can understand what they see on this picture, on this informational carousel of pictures describing what color temperature is and why they should care about using warm versus cold, or when you should use the one or the other. So the language that we are using, it needs to be super, super, super simplified. This is a big part of the lighting police talking to the general public. And then the third part of how to be involved is to be joining really the core team. So the core team is a team that consists of four members right now. It's me. And then we have Dipali Shirshad, who is responsible for all the communications between the advisory board of the project and all the different initiatives that we create with different organizations. Then we have Anastasia Angeli, who is the responsible for social media. If you speak with, if you engage on social media with the lighting police, Anastasia is behind that. She is the one resharing the stories and interacting and making sure that we constantly, daily inspire people to observe and raise awareness about the right light. And then we also have our new member in the team. It's called Tanzina Khan, who is the person responsible for all the visuals and different graphics and the things that we produce. So if anyone is interested to get more into this whole kind of aspect of raising awareness and creating educational content and bringing research and simplifying this research and being part of this team, you're very welcome to reach out to us, because we do, we are very, it's a volunteering project as well. So we are all very passionate about that. And we are bringing a lot of input to achieve this goal of raising awareness. So those are the three ways to be involved in the project.
Very good. Yeah. Do you think there'll ever be a way, and Mike and I have talked about it before, is of actually enforcing the right light, like having organization do it? I know it's funding.
That's a great question, Greg. Thank you for bringing this up, because, you know, like, when I started this project, as I said, like, it was really kind of like a fun thing to see. Okay, let's see, you know, we always have our internal jokes, all the lighting designers, you know, we send these pictures between us and it's like, look at this picture, like, what is it, you know, like, or look at this, it's filled with, like, the humidity is really bad, like, why do they have this? This is pointing up the sky. Like, we always have this. So this whole thing started really as a joke between the community, always with a respectful way, which I'm going to get there a bit later on. But then, like, the vision in the future, and this is what we see right now, we see lots of different organizations and magazines and different parts of the industry coming to us and asking to collaborate and contribute more on what they do. For example, we have great support from ARC magazine and Dark Media in general, who has invited us multiple times to participate on various talks that they organize. And recently, like a few months ago, we had a participation at Clerkenwell Design Week in London, where we hosted a quiz, an interactive quiz between the participants and members of the advisory board hosting that and raising awareness, educating the audience, but also making sure that they interact and they play and they understand how they can very simply be aware. So now we see a progress on those 3 years of running this project. We see a progress and a lot of interest of the overall community and beyond coming to us and say, we want to organize like an educational workshop. Are you in? Can you contribute? Can you be part of this? And this is great, because this is, I mean, it's a big part of what I do as a person, as an individual as well. But this project is not about me, or it's not for me. It's for the global community. And that's the reason why, in general, like, you will see on my profile that I'm the founder of the project. But generally, what we put across on our social media and all the platforms is the network of the global experts who are there to...
How do you decide who's an expert and who isn't an expert?
That's a very good question, Michael. Thank you. Basically, at the moment, this has come through my personal kind of approach in the beginning, because when the project started, I approached some lighting design experts that they are there for many years in the industry, well-known lighting designers working in established and very respectful firms around the world. So they were part of my network. So I approached them and I said, this is their vision. This is what I'm planning to do. Are you in? Do you want to contribute? This is a time commitment. This is what we want from you. Are you in? And this is how was the approach initially. But now, today, we do receive lots of different requests from people saying, I would like to contribute. I would like to be part of it. This is my experience. This is my CV. I'm in the industry for years. And to be honest with you, it's not about who is an expert or not. For me, it's more about who is willing to raise awareness and who is willing to really, you know, spread the word and be an ambassador, really, of this project. So it's, of course, the people that they join, they need, in order to approve the content, they need to be experts and they need to know what they're talking about. But for me, this whole network that we are building, it needs to be inclusive. And it needs to have people from manufacturing industry, from designing industry, like, we want them all in. It's not about a lighting design group of people, just, you know, that's very important. Back to the previous question, just to close this up, I do envision in the future to have the strength as the lighting police to go to different municipalities or, you know, local communities and knock the door and say, look, we are a group of global experts around the world. This is what we do. This is what our vision is. And we would like to educate the local responsible people about electricity, about the lights, about whatever it is, to consider, for example, the simplest one, color temperature or maintenance or light pollution. And then from this, again, it's about educational. And then a very good idea would be to be able to bring some people together and correct some parts of poor lighting that nobody was there, and it's very difficult to get there now because, you know, so
I'm just going to interrupt you because I just want to talk about the problem I see with the lighting industry is that they're so focused on lighting. They need to focus on darkness. Right. So Greg is the CEO of the Lighting and Darkness Foundation, and I'm the executive director of the Lighting and Darkness Foundation. And that's a charity that we established, the NAILD, our trade association that produces this show, National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors, created to address this problem between the fact that the lighting industry is constantly, look at how light polluted Toronto is. You can see it behind me here on the screen. The problem is that the lighting industry needs to add and darkness to it. It needs to incorporate that lighting designers, lighting designers should be lighting and darkness designers, actually. They need to incorporate the idea that providing darkness, restoring darkness and preserving night. Greg's getting sick. I've been talking about this for a year and a half now. The lighting, I can see his head go, oh, God, he's going to talk about preserving night and restoring darkness. Oh, God, oh, he's going to say it again. But the problem is that lighting designers are constantly saying, well, yeah, we can add light there. Yeah, we can do this. Yeah. But they never say, no, we can't add light there. No, we should not.
I don't agree. I don't agree with you necessarily, Michael. But obviously, I don't know how it is in the U.S., but from where I'm coming from in terms of like my expertise and network and the lighting designers that I have around me, also members of the advisory board, I think we always, all of us, start from the darkness. Like for me, for example, as a designer, my vision is to start with the lights off and then
I only know one designer. I only know one designer in the history of interviewing people that was asked to design a lighting system. John Bullock was asked to design a lighting system and replied back to his client that you shouldn't do lighting here and still sent them his fee. I only know that happening on one occasion. And he replied to his client that this is not, you're in a lighting zone that's like this, and you can't do this lighting project because there's no way to do it.
That's a great point. I think that if we can connect the dots between both of the things that we shared before, I think that it's true that sometimes, you know, like obviously the lighting designer will be hired by the ex-client who wants something specifically. And then it depends really on you and your influence on how much you can contribute to this, you know, to how this project is going to be and turned around. I don't think that as lighting designers, we have that massive influence on some big projects.
Right, but I mean, it's a fundamental issue of integrity. So this is, and that doesn't mean that it doesn't get done, but let me give you another example. Let's say some town in the United States says, we want to light up the bottom of our bridge because it's going to look amazing if we light up the bottom of the bridge. Mm-hmm. And lighting designer comes along and says, actually, that's an ecological catastrophe. Because this is a salmon run and, you know, unless we're going to do this control system, but really you should never have lighting under there.
The lighting designers that I know, they are going to do that. They're going
to
say
they're going to come up with a way to do it and adjust the color temperature. And they're going to try to put controls on it. And they're never going to say no. They're always going to say, I've only heard of it once. And I've asked a lot of lighting designers this. They're never going to say, you know what, we can't do it. They're always going to say, there is a compromise out there. And I think that's the problem is that, you know, Katya, we need to get to a point where lighting designers are going to say, especially when in the darkness restoration and night preservation, light pollution space, where they say, you know what, no uplight, bud. But it's our mosque or it's our temple or it's our church and this is the heaven and earth connect here where God is and we want to uplight it, the church. And okay, I guess we can aim the light fixtures like this. And I mean, you know, whatever. It always ends up that there's lighting designers always end up compromising and they add the lights when they shouldn't. And that's my opinion. I've only heard of it once. And lighting designers need to take a stand, need to educate themselves that there are times when the answer is no light. No light.
Here's my fee.
Here's my fee.
No light. No, I absolutely agree with you. But again, like from my experience and from the people that I have been discussing that, like, and also like I just came back from the ILD conference in Berlin a few weeks ago, and there were a lot of discussions and talks about restoring the dark sky and how, what is our responsibility, how we can kind of protect and
I think it needs to be in the charter. I think you guys should put it in the charter that there are times when you have to specify no light. Your specification is nothing.
Okay. It's an interesting
If you don't, I would say that because it always turns out that there's some compromise available, and that's how you end up with a big light polluted city like you see behind me. Because there's always a way to protect darkness. There's always, we can do it with low Kelvin temperature. We can do it by aiming. We can do it by focusing. No, you can't. There's times when you cannot do it. And, you know, and so I think the lighting design profession should become the lighting and darkness design profession. And they should they should be clearly stated that there are times in certain lighting zones where you have to say no. There's no compromise here. There's no way to do this. And I just find that it doesn't happen. There's always a solution that involves a light fixture. And no, sometimes there needs to be a solution that doesn't involve a light fixture, Katya.
Yeah, okay. I agree. I agree with that approach. And I'm really glad that at least, you know, with the people that I collaborate with so far, there is this kind of starting from the darkness and light as less as possible. But you know, and again, we need to talk about context. We need to talk about where do we talk about. Like, I saw the new sphere in Las Vegas, right? And then, you know, there have been lots of discussions regarding that, about like light pollution and about the darkness. But yes, again, this is happening in Las Vegas, which is completely like, you know, the context of it is
The context matters. But listen, let me just make a point on that. Restoring darkness is very difficult because there's all manner of problems. So if you have a light polluted environment, it's going to be very difficult to do that because you have individuals, buildings, commercial properties, governments, municipalities, who owns the light, where is it going? We just upgraded it 2 years ago to LED, blah, 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 blah. But preserving night is very easy. It just means that lighting designers need to say no. You cannot build the mosque in the middle of a dark sky preserve and uplight the minaret or the steeple or the chapel. The answer is no. I'd love to see something formally stated by the IALD about that.
That's a very interesting call to action, actually, from this.
That's from what this I discussion. Do, just like you.
Yeah. Amazing. But that's the thing, like, again, just to connect all the dots again, it's all about coming together, all of us from different angle and different perspective, coming together and with a mission, because we all have this shared mission at the end of the day. We do want to preserve the dark sky and we want to be respectful as designers to the environment and to this world anyway. So it's all about like, okay, what is our, how can we take action? How can we raise awareness? How can we make sure that everyone around us understand about good quality of light as well? I mean, that's a massive topic. Like, I just want to make a point about color temperature. I'm a person that I love warmer color temperature in general. Mm-hmm. And it's not really because, you know, there is not really much research about color temperature and cultural context. We have been discussing this a lot in terms of, you know, within the lighting police, we have been discussing a lot about color temperature and cultural aspect. And there's no really much research to say, yes, the Mediterranean ones, they prefer cold. The Scandinavian ones, they prefer warm. Like, there is a little bit of something, but not, scientifically proven. So for me, I really, really prefer the warmer color temperature. The cold one,
I have an instinct on that. I have an instinct on that, okay? And I think cultural context is going to end up being irrelevant. Because I think what we're going to see is that our relationship to light at night is directly related to firelight. And that means all
human... Can you repeat that?
Yeah, so our relationship to a light at night begins with fire, okay? And so
fire,
I think all human cultures are going to be able to reduce it back to the fire and the idea of security and safety provided by warm, colored lighting. And I think we can throw the cultural context argument out the window. And instead of trying to research whether Asians like 5,000K, you're talking about personal preferences. You're not talking about cultural context. I think if we go anthropologically with it, we're going to find that we all evolve with firelight, whether we're black, brown, blue, green, or gray. And I think that's why the argument, that research needs to be done. So the argument for warmer lights can be pushed forward into exterior lighting at night. So yeah. I would say I don't think the cultural context position is worth researching. I don't think it's worth researching.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And where I wanted to take this is that in lots of local shops, you know, like even in Greece or in the UK as well, like in London, you get into a shop and you want to get a new light bulb for like the light that was the bulb that was burned, right? And then you get there and what you are getting pushed to is 4,000 and 5,000K.
Sure.
I mean, this is what I'm experiencing and like lots of the people around me. And then I have my mom, for example, that she's afraid now to let me go to the house or to her clinic because she did a mistake to not check the color temperature and she took the light bulb that they gave her, you know. And then it's like all about, okay, awareness. You need to know what you are buying. You need to know what are your options. You need to know that the warmer color temperature of 3000K will make it feel much better because of that. Or also, you should care about having only one color temperature, not having one bulb of 4,000 or 5,000, and then another one of 2,700. And this, and like, you need to think about the
we have a problem though.
As well.
Katya, we have a problem though. Is that lighting people care more about lighting than non-lighting people care about lighting? Okay.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
You know, it's just, that's a problem. We've gone 53.
How can we change that?
You know what? That's a good question. I think the first problem is that the lighting industry is largely uneducated. So before we start trying to educate the public, I think we should educate the industry. And so I love what you're doing on social media and answering these questions for people and putting simple stuff out there that's quick to digest. I love that. I think it's amazing. And we're going to talk more about that after we close the show, because there's a few things I want to talk to you about with that. But largely electrical distributors, lighting contractors, many people who call themselves designers, okay, reps and agents, know very, very little about lighting technology. And what they're doing is they're rebate chasing. They're chasing after utility rebates. They're representing a manufacturer's line so that that's what has to be sold. Hey, it's in my warehouse. I'm selling it, buddy. It's in stock, right? And so I think that ignores our moral obligation as an industry. And that obligation is, I hate to say it, but we've largely refused to accept that it's a moral obligation. And I think that comes from the highest levels of the lighting industry, you know, particularly when it comes to light pollution in the exterior environment. It's been, you know, all it is paying lip service to it. And that's why we started the Lighting in Darkness Foundation. Greg and I are the CEO and the executive director, but Nailed started it. But this is why, because the problem is not with the public. The problem is with the lighting industry.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. By producing also very low quality luminaires, for example, just a simple thing,
or fixtures obviously that can't be repaired, or fixtures that can never
exactly
be repaired.
Exactly.
Like, there's
exactly
just so many things that are horrible. Like, yeah. Katya, we've gone almost an hour, if you can believe it. I can't believe it.
Oh wow,
it, right?
Wow. Time flies. Okay.
Do you have any fantastic final thoughts for the listeners and viewers out there?
I think that what I would like to just say is that let's try together to, mm-hmm, you know, be more involved. Let's try to educate the industry, but also the people around us, like us as professionals. Even if we can influence 5-10 people around us in our closed circle, imagine what all of us can do together. And I see that. I see that from the beginning of this project, that I see lots of my friends right now, they are sending me pictures of being out and spotting wrong, you know, bad lighting in places. And they do it because they are more aware, because they see, because they know that they should notice those things. Mm. So my call to action, and the way that I would like to close that, is that we are responsible to bring more awareness to the people around us. And this is the only way that...
Is that a moral responsibility? Is it a moral obligation?
It is a moral obligation, yes. And it's also an obligation towards the profession as a whole as well. Because the more the people understand and appreciate the importance of the right light in the places that they are going out or in their houses, and also understand that they can control and they can influence their emotions by the lighting that they are under it, you know. Mm. I think that the more our profession is going to be growing and being more respected, and understanding that a lighting expert should be there in a project. So I see that like in a much, much bigger circle of things. But each of us, we have to do our thing to make the bigger industry grow and stronger. So that's my closing.
I only have a couple more thoughts. First one is Satco, Greg Eric, SATCO.com, buddy. Slip it in there while you're still listening. Go to Satco.com.
Do the light thing, do the right thing. That's their motto, and that's what we're talking about today.
And of course, the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. Come on, folks. If you think Greg and I are alone in this, there are 4 or 5 other guys that could have easily been one of the hosts of this show, and they're going to be at the convention. And then we got tons of other people there that sell light bulbs every day, so have warehouses full of lights, doing projects, doing all that kind of stuff. You think you're hot stuff? Come and show us, buddy. Come on down to the Nailed Convention, NEILD.org. Thank you for listening and watching. We love you guys.